Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good afternoon from New York, and welcome to the Council on Foreign Relations, Religion, and Foreign Policy conference call series. I'm Irina Faskanis, Vice President for the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. Thank you for joining us. As a reminder, today's call is on the record, and the audio will be available on our website, www.cfr.org. We're delighted to have Ellen Bork with us to talk about the relationship between China and Tibet. Ms. Bork is Director of Democracy and Human Rights at the Foreign Policy Initiative. Previously, she worked at Freedom House, where she directed projects assisting activists and dissidents around the world. Ms. Bork has participated in election observation missions to Afghanistan, Cambodia, Indonesia, and Ukraine, and she serves on the board of the International Campaign for Tibet. Ellen, thanks very much for being with us. It would be terrific if you could begin by giving us an overview of the relationship between China and Tibet and the religious oppression in the region of Tibetan culture and religion.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for the invitation, and I think this is a great and timely conversation to have, so thank you. I'm just going to start by saying that I think there's probably no other people for whom religion is as central to their identity as Tibetans. And China's repression of Tibetan Buddhism and Tibet generally is inextricably linked with the Chinese Communist Party's desire to destroy an independent and distinct Tibetan identity. For China, Tibetan Buddhism and the Dalai Lama are seen as not only and perhaps not even chiefly in religious terms, but in political ones. And they see Tibet and Tibetans as a separatist, subversive threat to China's territorial unity and ethnic unity. And they've taken, the Chinese Communist Party has been at great pains to construct a view of its relationship with Tibet historically that is at odds with what many scholars see. Although it is, I think, still a kind of a unique relationship over time. But since the Chinese Communist takeover, it has the party has been at pains to portray it and distort that historical fact in a way to use both for its control of Tibet and the way it presents Tibet internationally. So I plan to touch on a few issues as a basis for our discussion later, and I'm happy to entertain other ones, and please bear with me as I just tick off a few of them. First, I'll talk briefly about the current situation, including the escalation over the last few years of Chinese repression and the suicides by fire by close to 100 Tibetans. I want to mention also China's plans. I beg your pardon? I want to mention China's plans to take control of Tibet's Buddhist hierarchy, as well as China's international agenda on Tibet. Then I'd like to talk about the Dalai Lama's own plans for the future and the way he's responded both to China's repression and their attacks on him, as well as his own mortality. And then talk a little bit about the way Tibet is seen as in American policy terms, because I think that gives you an idea for how the world is responding to the situation. So I think those of you who are following this are obviously aware that the situation in Tibet is quite dire, not only because of Chinese policies, but because of this uncertain outlook, the coming change that will happen when the Dalai Lama passes away, and China's intentions to frankly, intensify already extreme level of repression. I'm sure you all know that China's occupied Tibet since the since the 50s, beginning in 1950, and then later consolidating its control when the Dalai Lama fled in 1959 and went into exile. There have been variations in the severity of China's policies, with some relaxation in the late 1980s. And at that time, there was some tolerance of, or greater tolerance of religion and rebuilding of monasteries that had been destroyed during the Cultural Revolution. But overall, I think it's possible to say that there's a continuity of extreme repression. And frankly, it's only gotten worse since the mid-90s, and then with successive waves The latest phase that we're really focused on began around 2008, when some peaceful protests then escalated into rioting that spread from the Tibetan Autonomous Region into the eastern part of Tibet, which is sort of governed a little bit separately. China lopped off a large part of Tibet's territory for governance reasons. Those spreading demonstrations kind of did a couple of things. They really triggered an understanding that China's policies of control have been not effective, and also that the Tibetan identity was really still very strong throughout a much wider area than perhaps the party would knew or would like. In response to that, repression was heightened in a number of ways. Some of the steps that expert Tibet groups are citing as unprecedented include efforts to strengthen control over Tibetan Buddhism and monastic institutions, with an emphasis on inculcating loyalty to the party and patriotism toward China. For those of you who are interested, a lot of the sources that I find helpful and rely on are the Congressional Executive Commission on China, which issues an annual report and does a lot of work in between, the International Campaign for Tibet and Human Rights Watch. All of those have noted the establishment of a Tibetan Buddhist Theological Institute in Tibet, and the kind of language that's used in governing Tibetan Buddhism is very strange to a Western ear, because it has to do a lot with struggling against the Dalai clique, safeguarding the motherland's reunification and ethnic unity, and things that really in our minds have nothing to do with religion or spirituality. Also, there's been a much greater intrusion into monasteries over the last couple of years, whereas previously the monks had been organized into certain kinds of committees to govern and control activities and manage various kinds of propaganda and indoctrination. In late 2011, there was a new measure, the establishment of monastery management committees, which effectively imposed civilian cadres in all monasteries in the Tibet Autonomous Region. And there was a kind of a similar but perhaps less intrusive measure that extended into non-Tibet Autonomous Region Tibetan areas. And again, these groups monitor monks and impose various kinds of education designed to separate or diminish loyalty to the Dalai Lama, denigrate the Dalai Lama and Tibetan aspects of Tibetan Buddhism and Tibetan identity. Alongside that, there's been a noticeable emphasis on cultural repression, with writers and singers and entertainers being detained, and discrimination against Tibetan language, with some Tibetan language textbooks being replaced with Chinese ones, and various other things, including also some detentions of people engaging in pilgrimages, particularly people who attended a major religious teaching the Dalai Lama gave in India in early 2012. Also, I just point out that in the last couple of years also, particularly at a major party conclave in 2010, the party is also viewing and expressing its policies on Tibet in strategic and security terms. And I think that's particularly relevant to China's international agenda on Tibet. It's been on the offensive for several years, claiming Tibet as a core interest, something it puts on a par with Taiwan. And it's something that its officials, including Xi Jinping and Wen Jiabao and traveling officials, routinely mention in kind of incongruous settings when they're at major economic dialogues and other things. They are intent on deterring interest in Tibet from other countries. And they've been pretty successful. I think President Obama fell afoul of that in a way in his decision to postpone his first meeting with the Dalai Lama. It's excellent that has not been repeated, that he's since met with the Dalai Lama, but it did have an effect, particularly because it sent a signal to some other countries that the United States was a little bit weak on this, and there was some fallout, including denials of visas for the Dalai Lama to travel and different kinds of policy statements that grew weaker from other governments, including, I think, the Danes, who are usually so staunch. So these kinds of things do have an impact, and China is assiduously hoping to, you know, to diminish international support for Tibet and going about it quite effectively. Having said that, I'd like to point out that in response to the self-immolations that I'm about to talk about, the U.S. government made some very good statements in December, maybe not as quite as high a level as I would like, ideally, but there was a distinct and noticeable rallying of American support for Tibet in December with some good statements, and Assistant Secretary Mike Posner met with some U.S.-based relatives of people who'd committed suicide by fire in Tibet. So moving on to that, as I think that's probably the most well-known Tibet story over the last couple of years, starting in 2009, but especially escalating in 2011 and 2012, Tibetans first monks and nuns, and then later lay people began a wave of suicide by fire or self-immolations. It's been perceived generally as a recognition of both despair and a sign of how 6 decades of Chinese occupation and policies have not been effective in diminishing Tibetan identity or satisfying Tibetans about the way they about their homeland. It's the motivations of the people who've committed suicide in this way. We're not always clear, but a number have it's been recorded by witnesses that a number of them have died calling out for the Dalai Lama's return to Tibet and other such things. Some of the suicides have also been linked to environmental or other economic issues connected to Chinese repression. I think also we have to also notice that as of last summer, I believe, a dialogue which has been fitfully carried on between Beijing and representatives of the Dalai Lama, it really completely fell apart, and the Dalai Lama's envoy to that dialogue resigned, citing the lack of progress. Also, another issue that I'll turn to right now is the Dalai Lama's, first of all, that he hasn't been allowed to return to Tibet, and there are no prospects for that, but also China's own intent appoint its own candidate to replace the Dalai Lama when he, in fact, passes away. The Chinese government has issued guidelines on reincarnation, which is fairly ironic coming from a communist regime. And in doing that, they have essentially said that the selection of the Dalai Lama will be subject to the control of the State Council. And they've already named several lesser incarnations, and most famously in 1995, they kidnapped the Panchen Lama, who is the most probably the second most prominent religious figure in Tibet. And in fact, they supplanted an imposter for him, and this imposter is now in his early 20s and is actually beginning to play a public role, including at a conclave in Hong Kong last year. So we can sort of begin to see, I think, a kind of alarming trend in that regard, and one that is, frankly, only likely to provoke unrest in Tibet. But I'd like to now turn to the Dalai Lama's own plans for the future, which I think are very interesting and deserving of study and support abroad. It's been reported that he's projected that, or predicted that, you know, the Dalai Lama, which, as you probably know, is normally chosen through a process of identifying a reincarnation in a small boy. He has said that the next Dalai Lama could be found outside Tibet. He's also said it's even up to Tibetans whether they want a Dalai Lama. So he's been thrown out some very interesting ideas about that. But going deeper and in a sort of religious sense, he's issued, in September 2011, he issued a major statement in which he rejected the role of the Chinese in choosing his successor, and actually did something which I'm not a religious expert, but something that I've read up on. He has essentially tried to respond to what one scholar has called the key weakness of the reincarnation system, and that is that normally identifying a reincarnation in a small boy leaves a long period before the the person reaches adulthood, and that is always a very risky period, both historically in Tibet and, of course, under the current situation. One analysis I've read indicates that the Dalai Lama is laying the groundwork for his successor to be identified as an emanation, not necessarily as a reincarnation in a child, and has laid out a number of ways that this could happen. One of them is, or two of them really are things that I think are easy for us to understand. One of them I can't say I fully understand. It has to do with identifying the same mind stream in another Lama. But other ones have to do with essentially recognizing a close personal contact of the Dalai Lama, or appointing someone else who fulfills the requirements in some way of being his emanation. I'm sure I've garbled that in some way, but I welcome anybody with greater Buddhist knowledge to correct me. I think the Dalai Lama's spiritual plan for his succession is really important to be understood alongside his another major step that he took also in 2011, which was devolving his political authority completely to an elected exile government. That government is today led by someone named Lobsang Sangay, who won election among voters, I think about 50 or 60,000 votes cast among the 150,000 exiles outside of Tibet, obviously. And the Tibetan Charter was amended to give him final executive authority. This is actually, I think, a very underappreciated aspect of the Dalai Lama's life and work, is his commitment to democracy. And I think it's something that actually requires a lot more attention from Americans and American policymakers as they try to see how to be supportive of Tibet in a future without the current Dalai Lama, who we know so well. So I'll just end. I think we're getting to the point where I should wrap up, but I just want to say that these things, China's not only their repressive policies towards religion in Tibet, but their plans for the future, Beijing's plans for the future, and the Dalai Lama's own approach to what should happen in the Tibetan leadership after he dies, have really not had yet any kind of serious response from the outside world, from supporters of Tibet or from the U.S. government or other democratic governments. I think one reason is it's so difficult to handle. I think historically the United States has subordinated its Tibet policy to other interests with China, and it's very uncomfortable to try to unravel that or roll it back. And we've focused instead on trying to preserve Tibetan religion and culture and language, and supporting the dialogue, which of course is now pretty much defunct. It's my view that we're coming to a point where we can continue that stance and be very ineffective and watch Tibet suffer even more and in some way be completely destroyed, or we can work with some of these principles that the Dalai Lama has laid out and try to use them to find a way to support them with a view toward changing the Tibet situation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ellen, for that terrific overview. Let's open it up to the group for questions and comments.
Thank you. At this time, we'll open the floor for questions. If you'd like to ask a question, please press...
I'm so sorry. I cannot hear the question.
Okay. Yes, ma'am. We're opening the floor for questions now. Anyone who would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the one key on your touch-tone phone. Again, press star one to ask a question. If at any time you would like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, press star 2. Again, to ask a question, press star 1. Okay, we'll take our first question from Anne Nguyen, Executive Director for Committee for U.S. Broadcasting.
Good afternoon. I'd like to ask about the role of Voice of America news service in so far as the situation in Tibet. Last year, the Broadcasting Board of Governors had proposed in their budget to eliminate this service, and we think it's very important at Committee for U.S. International Broadcasting, and I wanted to know what your what your opinion is on this. Do you think that it's vital? Do you think that it's insignificant? Where do you stand on this?
Absolutely. I think foreign broadcasting in general is in environments like this is very important. Both VOA and Radio Free Asia, I think, do a very important service. It's absolutely vital. I don't know. You probably would know better than I the status of that decision.
Well, that budget proposal, it was successful, but these things come up annually, and we're wondering
right.
for February if it comes up again, as things seem to be getting worse and worse in Tibet. And information.
So it's vital I would say it's vital from a news point of view, but also considering just the issue of language and the possibility of losing. I think communicating in language under Tibet's current circumstances is so important. So, absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Michelle Freyoff, University of Bern.
Yes, my question has to do with Bhutan, who's right in the middle of all of this. Do you have any sense as to what their status or how they're going to be impacted by this or how they have been impacted by this? I know that there has been talk about even China taking over much of their land. And so with them right in the middle, I'm just curious as to what your viewpoint is on that.
Sure. China is assiduously building, amassing, and deploying influence in neighboring countries, including Bhutan and Nepal. I think it's Nepal I'm more familiar with, because of the refugee, the role that Nepal has played as a way station for refugees on the way from Tibet to India, I think that has been received more attention, and China is active there, and the Tibetan refugee community in Nepal is under great pressure, and the Nepal government is in some sense acquiescing to Chinese pressure on a lot of issues. I was very pleased that at one point several months ago, Undersecretary Sherman, Deputy Secretary Sherman, Undersecretary Sherman went out to Nepal, and that kind of presence is vital. Bhutan, I think, is probably, I don't know Bhutan well, I think it's probably a little more sensitive. But I did hear one interesting comment, which was that Bhutan, which introduced democracy after a long time, that the king has told visiting dignitaries that one reason he did it was to assure himself of support from the international democratic community. So although I think it's a sensitive issue that they don't really like to talk about very much, I suspect that Bhutan is highly aware of Chinese encroachment of all kinds. And on the Nepal front, I know that Chinese security officials enter into Nepal and have been documented to effectively illegally repatriate refugees. So all of that belt around in the Himalayas is very sensitive and bears a lot greater attention and active diplomacy and other things from the United States and other countries.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Again, to ask a question, you can do so by pressing *1. Our next question comes from William Hughley, University of San Diego.
Yes, thank you. You have already begun to touch on it with regard to the Tibetan influence in Nepal itself. I spent a month there myself recently and had a sense that there was a certain section of the country that was already being very deeply influenced by the Chinese, which is to say material goods to supply the needs of the people with boxes marked on from China and your friends there. The religious strength of Tibetan community in Kathmandu itself. Could you speak to those two questions, that is to say, the material intrusion of China into Tibet and how strong the Tibetan exile religious dimension is in Kathmandu itself?
I've actually heard Tibetans comment about what you described, the Chinese, you know, in, I don't know how to put it, the economic influence through trade, the ability of China to, you know, flood the market with cheap goods and that kind of thing. And so it's very, as you said, you saw it yourself, and it's very prominent there. And also China's engaged, you know, they have Confucius Institutes. They are very interested in cultivating elites, and they're doing that in Nepal. I had a number of, when I was there about a year ago, I had a number of journalists and foreign policy people describe junkets that Nepalese are taken on to, you know, to, and journalists, and there's a sense of self-censorship. Also, I suppose one thing that's a little troubling is, while I was there, actually, there was some Nepali police raided some Tibetan institutions, and I won't go into great detail, but it wasn't really covered in the press. It only came up in the Indian papers, and I think there's a, even though in general there's pretty good relations between the Tibetan refugees and the Nepali people, for some reason, I think they're inured to China's pressure on the Tibetans, and in fact, a number of people I spoke to surprised me for them to say, "Oh, that happens all the time." So it's a little bit like that anecdote about, you know, a frog in heating water. I think people are feeling some of the severity of what's really going on. And I at the same time, I'd say that the Tibetan refugee community there is very strong. It's quite some of it is well off. There are some prominent business people. I stayed at a hotel owned by a Tibetan family, and they are able to provide charity. They support sometimes Tibetan religious pilgrimages. They're very entrenched there. I'd hate to see for that to change, but I think it's a little bit of an open question what the future of the Tibetan refugee population or long-time Tibetan settled population is there. It's estimated, I think, at about 20,000 to 30,000.
Mm-hmm. That's right, I heard
you. So I'm a little worried about it. At the same time, I'm pretty impressed with it, having seen it as you did.
Thank you. Next question.
I think your next question comes from Virginia Beres, U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops.
I was just wondering if with the new National People's Congress having been elected and Xi Jinping assuming the helm, whether you see that there's any possible evolution in terms of Chinese party attitudes towards Tibet?
That's a great question. I would kind of predict no. I know, I think people are very interested in Xi Jinping because his father knew Tibetan leaders, including the Dalai Lama, very well through his appointment to his work in Tibet, and knew the last Panchen Lama, I think, quite well. I think that can work both ways. I think people who are at the top of an entity like the Communist Party sometimes have to prove their bona fides and aren't able to kind of display any sympathy or such. Xi Jinping did, in fact, I think it was the 60th anniversary of the quote, peaceful liberation of Tibet. He delivered a major speech there that was pretty uncompromising. So I don't really see it coming from them. And I'm not so naive as to think that it can be, that it would be easy, but I would say they're no less likely than any other, he's no less likely than any other leader, perhaps, to be, I'm not sure what the answer is, but I'm not optimistic about him, but I still think it's a time where we have to attempt to interact with the top Chinese leadership on these questions. I hope that answers your question. But I think that I noticed that, you know, Wen Jiabao had said some slightly moderate things, and he often was touted as a kind of reformist, but I think within the party itself, it's extremely difficult to change doctrine on Tibet, and especially now with these kinds of strategic emphasis on territory and core interests abroad and so forth, I think it would be kind of difficult.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Derek Moore, East Carolina University.
Hello. Thank you very much for having this event. It's an important conversation to have, I'm sure. I would like to ask you a little bit about the self-immolations, what your read is on why it hasn't been more prominent in international media. You know, if we look back at the Vietnam War, the very famous self-immolation that took place there, protesting against the Catholic regime, was pivotal in changing international opinion about that regime and affected international relations. And yet we have 96, as of the 12th of January, we have 96 self-immolations having taken place in Tibet and more in exile communities around the periphery of Tibet. And yet there's almost no international reaction to this. I wonder if you could comment on why you think that is.
Thank you. That's a really daunting topic. I guess if I had to say, I don't know why that is. If I had to guess, it's because people, I think our policy, our feeling of expectations about the prospects for change in Tibet are so limited. And I think that's a function of China's own belligerence and, you know, commitment to a particular set of facts and a particular situation. And I think it's likewise attributable to the United States and other countries having very much acquiesced to this. I don't think that there's any real sense that some kind of solution can be found to the problem. And I think people are really at a loss. I personally think it would be quite difficult to change things, but I do think that the United States and other countries, we have more influence than we think, and that we should be doing more on this question. But I guess, in answer to your question briefly, I think it's a feeling of hopelessness. I think it's a feeling of hopelessness on the part of the Tibetans and internationally, and I would encourage, you know, all of us to attempt to make this issue seem both more widely recognized and less hopeless in one way or another.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. As a reminder, to ask a question, you can do so by pressing star 1. Our next question comes from Dawn Coyle, Cross Temple.
Hi, that's Dawn Coyle of Solar Cross Temple. And to follow up on that last statement about combating the feeling of hopelessness, I wonder about support from world religious leaders as a component in helping establish some of His Holiness's new ideas regarding succession. I wonder if those of us who lead communities and also do interfaith work, if we started discussing the implications of the philosophical and religious changes in the Dalai Lama's thinking, might we contribute to a deeper understanding by world citizens and therefore be able to affect political spheres? Because it strikes me, one thing you said was people don't quite understand where he's going with this change and what the implications of this change are. And it feels to me like world religious leaders have a great opportunity here to support him by just discussing his ideas and gaining deeper understanding ourselves and then spreading that to other people, including our political leaders, to put greater pressure on them.
I think that is brilliant, and I would be so thrilled to help in a small way. I'm obviously not a religious leader, but that would be an extraordinarily positive thing to do, and would help enormously. I do think some of the religious issues seem esoteric to people. I look at it as from a sort of religious freedom point of view that we should support, especially the Dalai Lama's chosen path, particularly because of the repression that is aimed against it. I would love to talk more with you and anyone else on this call about doing that. I think it's vital and fantastic.
What's the best way for us to go about continuing that conversation?
Well, you mean a sort of a preliminary conversation? Or,
yes.
Or within your faith communities? Or
yes, or how could we work with you to get more information or, you know, vice versa?
Let's agree to follow up next week with emails and a phone call and start corresponding and speaking. And involving anyone who on this call or that others that you identify, I'd be more than happy to. I'd be very happy to make connections to you, to other groups involved in Tibet, or I think there are a lot of ways to go about it, and we shouldn't rule anything out. Let's just do it. That sounds great.
Wonderful.
This is Irina here. If you're interested in being part of this group, please email outreach@cfr.org, and then we can set up a list and start this exchange and dialogue.
Great.
Fantastic.
Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Homi Gandhi with Federation of Zoroastrian Associates of North America.
Thank you. This is Homi Gandhi. Thanks for taking my question. I came a little bit late, but what I heard from the last question and a follow-up on that is that although the religious leaders, and I'm a Zoroastrian, and I would be very much interested in helping that process out, even if the religious leaders are interested, is Dalai Lama giving the different signals that he doesn't want to go to the route which he has been already long before? Because if you see his comments, which are coming out from time to time, it's been mellowed down considerably, and although he's not accepting the fact that as it is, what's happening, is he willing to participate in this dialogue?
Let me clarify. You're asking, is he still committed to a dialogue with Beijing?
Right.
I guess that's a question. My impression is that he's been totally disappointed by the whole process. I'm trying to think what I just saw of his. I'd be very surprised if there were a good faith effort from the Chinese side that the Dalai Lama and Dharamsala wouldn't respond to it. So I think it's very much a function of how serious China has been over many years. The lack of seriousness. That's my impression.
But China has not been serious, and China is not going to be serious.
That's
but
a good point.
If the faith leaders are going to take the track of commencing the dialogue, would Dalai Lama be interested in working together? That's my question.
Oh, I think maybe I'm not sure. I think we might be talking about two different things. I think as you joined the call, we were talking about how faith leaders could study and understand and help other lay people understand the Dalai Lama's choice about his own succession and those issues, as opposed to the actual Sino-Tibetan dialogue on autonomy or related issues, which are two different things. So, unless I'm mistaken, and I don't think that I think that the Dalai Lama his chosen steps for carrying on his office after his death are very consistent with any kind of, dialogue between Tibetans in exile and Beijing. I don't think that complicates that at all. In fact, I think there needs to be a serious partner for the Chinese to engage with. I actually agree with you about the dialogue. I think it's not serious because of the Chinese attitude. But I think the only thing that could make it more serious is an understanding on Beijing's part that the Tibetans enjoy international support, that there's a commitment to them being allowed to, have their spiritual leader, that they are committed to a democratic government in exile and democracy in Tibet and China. So I don't see any of these things as being inconsistent with each other.
Thank you. Next question or comment?
Thank you. As a reminder, please press star 1 to ask a question. Our next question comes from William Heasley, University of San Diego.
Yes, I was just going to comment on that resource question, but I'll do that offline. I'll join that group and make the contributions then. Thank you.
Let me say one thing while I'm thinking of it, which is, and I'm sure Irina has my email, and she is authorized to give it to anybody on this call that would like it. And it is eBork, E-B-O-R-K, at foreignpolicyi.org. I'm having trouble sometimes hearing your names as they are announced, and I certainly don't want to I'll be able to get them, but I wanted you to have a way to reach me.
Great. As we wait for other questions to queue up, I want to follow up, Ellen. You've talked about the United States and recommended it should work with its European allies, Japan and India, to reverse the pressure coming from China, the repression. How can these nations work together to exert pressure?
Well, I guess I think that I think anything that the United States does with its allies on Tibet, that the first response will be very strong and angry and painful opposition from China. So I don't want to in any way appear Pollyanna-ish and suggest that, you know, it'll just be fine if we all get together and have a policy. I don't believe that. But I think, unfortunately, that some of that response from China, you know, can be a sign that you're getting somewhere, that you're unfortunately, you know, you're hitting a nerve, and you have to be willing to endure that. One of the things that I wrote about recently and was, and I've been writing about in a number of different places, is my belief that America's policy on Tibet historically, you know, has been to subordinate it to other interests with China, from the open door policy to trying to have China as a counterweight first to Japan and then to the Soviet Union, and that effectively the truth of Tibet's case for independence, first off, has really been obscured by those geopolitical interests. And I've tried to argue that America, that may make me a little bit uncomfortable, but it also really shows that the United States is flexible when it comes to its geopolitical interests. And I would argue that today, defending Tibet in some way, defending Tibet, not necessarily seeking independence, but protecting Tibet's identity, alleviating the suffering there, is obviously a moral imperative. But even as a strategic imperative to deal with Tibet, to look back at the way we've subordinated Tibet to China, our interests with China all this time, that we should try to kind of unravel that and begin to see where a principled case for support for Tibet takes us. And I think it actually, when you look at the record, you know, America thought Tibet was independent when China invaded. It had been independent since at least 1912. And, you know, the history before that is quite complicated. And John Garver, who's a very important historian of China and India, has called it the relationship between China and Tibet sui generis. I don't think we need to get bogged down in the independence case to embrace an idea that Tibet, you know, things should be different in Tibet and that what happens in Tibet is a matter of great concern. It's certainly a matter of great concern to India, which is a growing, not ally, but partner of the United States. When I was in India, I have to say, I shouldn't have been surprised, but the degree to which Tibet is an issue there is so different than here, where it's very much a human rights issue and a religious issue. There is a strategic question. The source of so much of Asia's water is in Tibet, and that affects India, you know, directly, not to mention having PLA troops on your border. So all of these, you know, the United States, which is such a power in Asia and has such close relationships with India and Japan and cares about the stability of Asia, is really, I think, needs to be more engaged in Tibet as a major issue in its foreign policy than it has been up until now.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. There are no further questions at this time. Again, to ask a question, you may enter the queue by pressing star 1. We have a question from Derek Moore. East Carolina University.
By its member of the Tibetan cabinet. It's called 100,000 Moons by Tsipun Shakapa, and he was a major player in the Tibetan government for decades.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very steeped in how the Tibetans configure, you know, their own historical relationships with China, and I'm also familiar with how the Chinese configure that, and they are at such odds. You know, it seems to me that China's way of dealing with others is that they establish a narrative about how they wish things were, you know, that they, and then they insist on it tooth and nail. And they'll deal with you as long as you accept their basic narrative about the point in question. And if you don't, then they don't want to even have a conversation with you. And I'm sure you're familiar with the phenomena that I'm talking about. It's sort of a different disposition than you normally find in international relations, where everything is, you know, where things are up for negotiation and conversation. But for them, it's just you have to completely buy into their narrative or else the conversation can't move forward. This does pose really unique problems, I think, for trying to enact the kind of changes in communication about the problems that Tibet confronts. And I wonder if you have any, if your research has led you to any insights on how to counteract that kind of disposition in international relations.
That is a great question. But first of all, I commend you on your work on the Shakapa. That's really impressive, and I'm sure you know a lot more about Tibet and China than I do. But and if we could both answer that question about sort of breaking China's negotiating behavior, we'd probably get the Nobel Peace Prize. I don't know. I do think that there's something to be said for not sort of mystifying it the way it often is. I think there's also strength in numbers. I think China's been extremely effective at isolating, you know, and breaking down, the human rights coalition. You know, lots of countries, they use trade benefits, they use other kinds of things very effectively, and isolate and defeat individual countries one at a time. So I'm very keen on exploring the ideas of joining together. I think it's extremely difficult, but I think the first task is diplomacy among the sympathetic friends of Tibet to find a way to have a united front of our own. It really distresses me to see, someone like the president of Estonia, Thomas Ilves, you know, follow through and meet with the Dalai Lama, and then no one else does. You know, none of the other Baltics do, and they see him and his countries get, their trade opportunities reduced, and they have to live with being called all kinds of horrible things. I think we haven't tried it, but I think there's a lot more that could be done if we were willing to identify some common proposals and stick with them. Probably we should do a study of China's behavior in the Human Rights Commission and then Council to see how effective they became there and take a lesson from that, because they effectively ruined that forum, you're right. Our outlook is so much different, and I don't think we have to behave in quite the same way, but we have to learn how to defend against it and come up with alternatives. And I think become less. I suspect that we could all find examples where China was actually stood up too, and we can find out what that was all about. There's a lot of theatrics involved, but I take your point about how absolutely effective they are in that way and how daunting it is to go up against it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Is that persuasive at all?
A glimmer of hope is there.
Okay.
Do you want to offer your observations as well?
Well, I feel, there are plenty of cases. I mean, you mentioned about Nepal earlier, and you can go back into the even 18th century and find cases where China influenced Nepal through to sort of reinforce Chinese perceptions of Tibet or Chinese depictions of Tibet. China's constantly doing this, getting first the British and later Americans have wanted to participate in economic relationships with China, and part of the price of admission is to at least not criticize or, you know, outwardly oppose their narratives about Tibet. It's been going on for a very long time, and it's to me quite a it's a powerful strategy since they have the power to call the terms. They just stiff arm anybody who even admits that there's some ambiguity about their utterly false narrative about Tibet.
Right. I'd just like to add here one thing that I think is worthwhile and worth inserting into, you know, our policy and our approach to it, which is, even though the Chinese Communist Party really cultivates a kind of, you know, nationalism with regard to Tibet, and even though that may be fairly widespread or widely held belief inside China, it's not as monolithic as the party would like, or it doesn't have to be, and it certainly doesn't have to be as monolithic as the party would like. And what's always struck me is the degree to which China's dissidents are willing to counter or disagree with their government's views on Tibet, even if they, you know, they're not for independence or something. They have a kind of a humanitarian or a they have a different approach to rights, and they see Tibetans as having had their rights denied, and they're open to this, and frankly that makes those dissidents that much more vulnerable to repression themselves. But those kinds of issues, those kinds of activities by dissidents have not always been given as much attention from outside as they should be, and I think these things can break down fairly fast. Also, there's and maybe you know about this as well, the attraction of Tibetan Buddhism among Chinese who are, you know, open to faith is something that is growing. And the Dalai Lama has visitors from mainland China in northern India in exile. Those things, I think, are bigger than people give them credit, and they could be a lot bigger. The Dalai Lama has engaged in at least one online dialogue with ordinary Chinese who access the internet and pose questions to him, and this has been facilitated by a famous Chinese writer dissident who himself happens to be married to a Tibetan. And all of these things, I think, are hopeful. They're not decisive, but they are worth developing and supporting and being aware of.
Mm-hmm. Great, thank you very much. Are there any last questions before we wrap up?
Again, please press star 1 to ask a question. There are no further questions at this time.
Well, Ellen, we're at the close to the end of our time here, so I don't know if you want to share any final thoughts before we end.
I guess I don't. I just want to say that I was delighted to have a proposal to keep talking about this, I'd love to speak to all of you, anyone who would like to, again, and correspond. I apologize, I didn't get all your names, but I have the roster, and do contact me. The prospect of maintaining your interest in this is something that I'm really open to, and hope you'll get in touch, and we can move forward with that one excellent idea.
Sounds great, and I second that. This conference call, we hope to do that and to foster exchange and dialogue on important foreign policy issues with religious and congregational leaders and scholars. So we'll send out a follow-up email. If you would like to be part of this group, please email outreach@cfr.org, and then we will connect you with Ellen. You can also include any suggestions on topics you would like to see covered in future conference calls. To that end, our next call will be on February 13th, and it will feature Eboo Patel, who's the founder and president of the Interfaith Youth Core, and he'll be talking about Sacred Ground, Pluralism, Prejudice, and the Promise of America, which is his new book. Thanks, everyone, again, and look forward to your participation and continuing this dialogue online.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.